Good afternoon, everyone. We're very excited today to have Rob Mason with us. We, as you hopefully know by now, you know, one of the things that Alan really would like us to focus our advocacy on or improve our advocacy on is for the crossover kids, the kids that are in the delinquency system. And Rob was kind enough to agree to be our first speaker in this series and to kind of give us a general overview of the delinquency system and the dependency system. Rob is a longtime public defender out of the Fourth Circuit, and he's been very active as a child advocate for all of his career and served on a number of committees, both locally and I think also nationally, to advocate for children. So, and in fact, I have memories of Alan being at delinquency meetings with Alan and Rob, and they often, it was interesting to see, they weren't always on the same side of the issue. So it's nice that we can all come together on this issue and come up with some effective advocacy.
Dial the right number.
Is it different than a 10?
See, there's someone that needs to be muted.
Hey, Brad, we can hear you.
What we're going to do in just a minute, we're going to, as soon as I'm done talking, Alicia's going to mute the line. So, but Rob has worked on the crossover project in the Fourth Circuit, I believe, since January of this year. Rob can correct me if that's wrong, but they've gotten that going recently, and Rob's going to tell us, based on that experience, what has worked and what hasn't, and then give us tips for where we as guardian ad litem can be most effective in our advocacy for these crossover kids. So I want to remind everyone that we're going to be putting everybody on mute. So you can either email Alicia a question, Alicia Guerra, you can find her in your address book. If you're a volunteer and you don't have access to Alicia's email, we will unmute the line at the end of the call and give time for questions. So, write down your question if you're worried you'll forget it or whatever, because Rob has graciously agreed to stay on and answer questions after if you have any. So with that, I'm going to go ahead and hand it over to Rob. And Rob, again, if I left anything out of your bio, I apologize that I should have mentioned. You may want to give them a little more on exactly the nuts and bolts of your project you guys have over there in Duval.
Okay, thanks, Mary Kay. Again, my name's Rob Mason. I've been a PD since 1990. What I'm going to do today is, besides talking about our crossover court, I'm also just going to talk about how a juvenile case originates and how the process is, because I think it's helpful as either a guardian ad litem attorney or a guardian ad litem volunteer to understand the process better. And that's one of the great things about crossover court is the delinquency folks start learning a little bit more about dependency and how things work, and vice versa.
Presentation mode is now enabled.
Excellent. What we have in Jacksonville is a dedicated crossover court with Judge David Gooding. What that means is, if a child is in Duval County with an active dependency court case and he or she picks up a delinquency charge, instead of going to a regular court with a delinquency judge, it goes to this special court. Now, we have this court Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday. Because of the staffing issues, we start it at 8:30. In theory, it's supposed to end at 9. Frequently, it goes much longer than that. I've assigned attorneys in it that are in a division with a judge who starts late, and we've been pretty successful with it so far. But I wanted to explain a little bit about the public defender mentality. We have an attitude that it's us against the world, and that's because we have to fight so many people, and we have to fight everything. So I just, as guardian ad litem, of course, you guys are in a different role. since we are continually advocating the expressed interest of the child, sometimes when you guys come in and advocate what you believe to be the best interests, that's going against what our client wants, and that's going against what our ethical and legal responsibility is in trying to represent the child. What that means is sometimes we don't have a lot of interest in what you guys are saying. If we know that you think a child needs to be sent off to some residential commitment and that the child doesn't want that to happen, so nobody should take it personally. I mean, it's the same way we deal with parents. It's the same way we deal with probation officers. When we see somebody that can help our cause, we're going to buddy up with them. When we see somebody that won't help the cause, we're going to either try and neutralize them or try to get them. If we can't get them to see things our way, we're going to try and push them to the side a little bit. So in terms of how a juvenile case originates, and hopefully the materials that I submitted to Mary Kay have been distributed, I'm basically going to talk about the four pages on the flow chart. And what I'm going to do is going to run through the process so that you have a pretty good understanding of the delinquency process. And then I'm also going to talk about ways that you guys can help us. And basically, there's two ways that a case is going to start. It's either going to start because of police making contact with someone, or what we call here locally a walk-in complaint. Now, I've heard that before called a mail-in complaint. So it might be called different things around the state. Sometimes on these walk-in complaints, sometimes the police are involved, sometimes they're not. Many times the police look at a case, they don't necessarily think that it needs to go any further. They will give a state attorney card to an alleged victim. And with that state attorney card, that alleged victim can go to the state attorney's office and say, hey, I think that a crime's been committed, and I think somebody should be arrested, or I think somebody should be prosecuted. Here's what happened. Those are kind of the low cases on the totem pole for the prosecutors, because there's no time limits attached, and basically, the more aggressive a victim is to get something prosecuted, the more likely it is to get prosecuted. Most of the cases we see come from some type of police contact, meaning the police have contact with the juvenile, and they're investigating a crime, and they're making a decision as to what should happen. And if you look at that first page on the flow chart, when the police come in contact with the juvenile and when they're investigating a crime, there's essentially four different things they can do. One, which they don't do enough in this state and certainly in this circuit, is they basically can give the child just a really stern lecture. Maybe it's a trespass case. Maybe it could potentially be a resisting without violence, some type of misdemeanor, where the officer could just say, you know, you could be arrested for this, you could be taken to the assessment center, you could be put on probation, you could be locked up, you could have all these bad things happen, and you shouldn't do this type of behavior. And, you know, that's what happened when I was growing up. It seems now that that's not as common. It seems now that if the police feel that there's probable cause for an arrest, by golly, they're going to make the arrest. So that's the best case scenario for the child, because the child's not processed through the legal system. Now, what the officer can also do is give a child a notice to appear. And it's not an arrest, but it's like writing up a ticket saying, you need to come into court, you know, 3 or 4 weeks down the road and potentially face these charges. if the state filed. Another option is something called a civil citation. And civil citations are real popular now. They're being pushed. The present secretary of the Department of Juvenile Justice, Wansley Walters, she was very involved with the civil citations in Miami. And what civil citations do is, instead of a child being arrested, they go to some type of program, some similar to diversion program like teen court, something with some sanctions in it. And if they successfully complete it, the child won't have a record. So it's very, very beneficial to protect the record of the child. And what we found is, despite what people think, most children that first get involved in the system with an alleged crime generally don't repeat it. I mean, basically, they learn their lesson. But what happens is we have a certain population that has charge after charge after charge, and then it becomes widely reported that all these kids get in trouble and probation doesn't work and diversion doesn't work. But that's really not true. So the police can lecture the child, they can give a notice to appear, they can give a civil citation, or they can take a child to something called a juvenile assessment center or a call center. Now, there are not juvenile assessment centers in all the counties. What a juvenile assessment center is a building, and it's usually connected to the detention center, but a child is brought there, and essentially the child is screened for substance abuse, for mental health issues, and family issues, etc. And at that JAC, the Juvenile Assessment Center, we commonly refer to it as the JAC, at that point, the assessment center will make a decision as to, should this child spend the night in detention? Do we process him from the JAC and take him to detention where he's going to appear in front of a judge the next day, or can we just give this child an arraignment date? Much of this is based on something called the Detention Risk Assessment Instrument, as to whether a child will be kept at the detention center or just given an arraignment date. A child is entitled to be in front of a judge within 24 hours of being arrested. Now, what happens between whether a child has that detention hearing or whether a child has an arraignment date scheduled or whether it's a walk-in complaint, the state attorney's office, at this point, they do their own investigation. And there's essentially five different things that the state attorney's office can do. One is they can actually indict a child. That's done if a child's under 14 and it's a felony that's potentially punishable by life. So that's somewhat rare. The state can also direct file a child. Now, what direct file means is to prosecute a child at the adult level. Any felony, if a child's 16 or 17, any felony can be direct filed. If a child's 14 or 15, there's enumerated felonies, and they're quite lengthy. Those children can also be direct filed. So the indictment and the direct file would take the case out of the juvenile system and into adult court. The other options the state has was, one, they could just not file a case. Essentially just do what's called a drop notice or a no action, saying they don't believe that it's worthwhile or they don't believe that the facts would sustain a conviction. The state could also divert the case, meaning send it to diversion, which is an agreement between the state attorney's office and the child to basically do some sanctions, letters of apology, perhaps some community service hours, perhaps some anger management classes, something of that ilk. And if the child successfully completes it, then the child will not have anything on the record. The other thing the state can do, of course, is to file the petition. Now, when they're making this decision, whether to divert, whether to file, that's where the guardians can come in and be pretty helpful. What you can do is you can, if you're in contact with the defense attorney as appointed, you can help tag team the state attorney who's working the case. Maybe a child's already had one diversion case, and the state generally doesn't like to divert a second case. Well, if you've got the information concerning some of the mitigation in this child's life, that can be used to also to convince the state to send a case to diversion, or maybe that can be used so that they won't file the higher charge. So you always need to try and talk to the child's attorney, and if there's some significant mitigation, it should be discussed with the child's attorney, and sometimes that might be enough for the defense attorney to talk to the state, but it's always really, really great for the guardian ad litem additionally to talk to the state. And it's really great to tag team that way. Before we talk about what happens with once a petition is filed, I want to go to the second page of the flow chart and just explain what happens at first appearance. As I had mentioned, first appearance is to happen within 24 hours of the child being arrested, and first appearance is commonly referred to as detention hearings. This is also an area where it can be really helpful for a guardian to be present in court and to potentially testify in court to help a child get released. Because what happens at first appearance, there's basically four main things that will happen. One is the appointment of counsel. It's somewhat inconsistent around the state of Florida. Here in Duval County, every child gets appointed a lawyer. It's very, very rare that there's any waiver of counsel. Some places around the state, though, that isn't the situation. In some places around the state, there's upwards of even 50% of children waiving counsel. Now, there was a lot of work done, and it was done both through the Legal Needs of Children Committee as well as the Juvenile Rules Committee, 8.165, which is a rule of juvenile procedure that, besides saying that a waiver of counsel has to be written and has to be in open court, it also says that there has to be a meaningful opportunity for the child to confer about waiving counsel. And it's a very significant rule, and I know there's a lot of listeners on this call that had a lot to do with passing it, so I commend them for their advocacy. Basically, it means that before a child can say, I don't need an attorney, or before the parent says the child doesn't need an attorney gets involved and basically says, hey, this has some serious consequences, some really bad things could happen, you need a lawyer. So, appointment of counsel happens. There's also a probable cause determination. The charges are announced to the child, so the child knows what he or she has been arrested for, and then there has to be a probable cause determination based on what's in the affidavit, based on what's in the police report. Because sometimes what happens is they arrest somebody for something, but if you look at what they've put in the police report, it's not legally sufficient. And at that point, Sometimes a child will be released. Sometimes the case will be passed for 24 hours for the state attorney's office to attempt to get the required probable cause. The other thing about detention hearings is they vary dramatically around the state. Here in Duval County, they are very well litigated, and we'll spend a lot of time arguing probable cause if appropriate. We'll spend a lot of time arguing the detention risk assessment, whether it's correct or not. When I go around the state and talk with other lawyers, I've found that in some jurisdictions, it's basically just a cattle call, and you're not going to have an opportunity to make these arguments. By law, you should be able to. So counsel's appointed, probable cause is determined, a next court date is scheduled. It's not always an arraignment date. Sometimes if a child's detained, it may be passed for just a couple of days so that everybody knows a little bit more and a more informed decision can be made. And then the last and most significant, at least to most of the children, the fourth thing that happens at this first appearance detention hearing is the release status is determined. And again, it's based on the detention risk assessment instrument, which is an overly complicated statute. In theory, it's good because it's based on points. The more serious the charge, the more points you get. The prior record can score points. Being on probation or under committed status scores extra points. In theory, it all makes sense, but in practicality, it's become so convoluted and so complicated. I'm not sure how many people around the state even completely understand the risk assessment. But it basically will dictate what happens in the vast majority of the cases. So what can happen when at first appearance and release status is, one, is the child can stay in secure detention. That's the worst case scenario for the child. Now, the other thing is a child could score less points and could be released on home detention. Home detention is like house arrest. Home detention may or may not include the electronic monitoring device or the ankle monitor. There's also something called non-secure release, which unfortunately we don't have in Jacksonville right now, but they have around the state, which is like a group home. We also have something called the alternative to secure detention. And what this alternative to secure detention is, it's like a glorified home detention. Part of the problem with home detention is the Department of Juvenile Justice no longer has the ability to have people monitor it. And by and large, it's monitored by the parents. But alternative to secure detention has usually former probation officers that will go out and make contact with the child, make sure he's at school, he or she, make sure that they're at home, will deal with the parents, and just basically monitor the home home detention very significantly.
So that's what?
So it's really three.
If you're released on home detention, secure detention, non-secure, or alternative to secure detention, there's a 21-day limit for trial.
You're going up on somebody.
The best release situation is straight release. If somebody's on straight release, we have a 90-day speedy trial limit, but there's not a 21-day limit for trial. Now, this 21-day limit for trial, again, this is something where it's dramatically different around the state. in Duval County and in some of the other jurisdictions, the prosecutors have an amazing ability to put a case together very, very quickly and try it within 21 days. In some parts of the state, they can't do that. There are many parts of the state where if a child scores for secured attention, a child might stay locked up for 21 days, and then at the end of 21 days, just be released, and then their case may or may not be processed. Again, in Jacksonville and some other places, they can put these cases together. So what happens is, we have to make a decision as a defense lawyer. Can we be ready for this case within 21 days? And whose advantage is it? If the case is very defensible, or if it's a case that we want to take depositions or do further investigation, we tend to waive the 21 days. On cases where there's very strong evidence and there's confession and eyewitnesses, and it just looks like the state would have very little trouble prosecuting the case, that might be a case that if it's going to go to trial, we would just as soon see it go to trial as soon as possible, because we know that the more time the state has, the more likely they'll have a conviction, and the 21-day trial problem can, or the 21-day limitation puts more pressure on the state than on the defense. Again, the release status is really critical, and that's why if a guardian has good things to say about a child, if a guardian can explain the circumstances that a child is in and can explain that a child's really been doing quite well for the last 6 months or whatever, it helps a lot to be in court. All too often when we have crossover kids, we don't have anybody in the detention here. Now, as part of our project and as part of the crossover court we have, we come to court the next possible day, and then we'll have the guardian and we'll have the case managers and we'll have the other people in the system. But somehow just that initial determination, it just seems to create this, he's locked up, a judge made a decision to keep him or her locked up, we just need to stay the course. So it's really, really helpful for the guardian to be present. Additionally, if we have those cases that didn't get to a detention hearing, if we have those cases where maybe a child was sent to diversion, it's really helpful for the guardian to work with the child and to convince the child how important things are to successfully complete this diversion so that they don't have anything on their record, so they don't have to come back to court. You need to realize that these cases that come through and maybe get sent straight to diversion, a defense lawyer may not be appointed to. So there's nobody really to advise the child and to try and encourage the child, to coach or mentor the child to successfully complete the diversion. So that's one of the areas where the guardians can come in. Now, in moving towards what happens if a petition is filed, that's the third page of the flow chart. A case will be scheduled for the arraignment, and we have the delinquency petition filed. Now, in our crossover court, it's really helpful because we have the guardian, we have the case managers, and we're able to develop a lot of the mitigation, and we're able to put a lot of things on the record in front of the prosecutor. We have some cases that won't be crossover because the child may actually be from a separate county, and is just temporarily in Duval County. And again, that's why if a guardian can make the effort to go to all of the courtrooms and to try to be there for all of the children, it would be very significant. When a child comes to their arraignment, there are basically two things that the child can do. The child can enter a plea of not guilty, which is almost always the best thing to do, or the child can enter a plea of no contest or a plea of guilty. Although most judges around the state, I've noticed, do not like to let the child enter a plea of no contest, and that the court doesn't have to accept a bargain. Now, if the child is pleading straight up, meaning as charged, the child does have a right to plead no contest. Generally, the best thing to happen is to plead not guilty and just look into it a little bit more. Now, the other thing that's going on at this point, besides the investigation of the case that the defense may be doing, we're also looking at the overall best interests of the child, although that's not guiding legally what we do. But there may be a number of evaluations that are going to be conducted at this time. There may be substance abuse evaluations. There may be mental health evaluations. There may be psychological evaluations. There may be psychiatric evaluations. On sex cases, there may be psychosexual evaluations. And, of course, there may also be competency evaluations. It's interesting because these evaluations are being conducted at basically all levels. As part of the defense, we may make a decision that we think one of these evaluations will help us. We're not sure, and often we'll do it as a confidential evaluation. That means that we pay for it out of our due process funds. That also means we don't share it unless we think that it helps the client. So I know a lot of times guardians or other officials will say they understood that somebody was seen by Dr. Knighty or Dr. Bloomfield or Dr. whoever, and they want the evaluation, and we'll say, no, we paid for it. That's our evaluation, and we're not disclosing it. Sometimes we'll have a court evaluation. Many of the competency evaluations, we will file something called a suggestion of incompetency, and it will be a court evaluation. The court evaluation means everybody's supposed to get it. Now, it may only be sent to the defense attorney. In theory, it's supposed to be sent to everybody. Legal competency is a pretty low threshold. We try to make a determination when we talk with the child to make sure that the child understands what's going on. Now, they don't have to understand it perfectly, but they have to have a pretty good understanding. They need to have the ability to testify in court if need be, although it's the child's choice. They need to have the ability to speak with the lawyer and assist in the defense and answer questions we may ask factually. They need to have the ability to rationally understand what their options are. Again, they don't need to have the perfect ability. So there's some children that really, they're not rocket scientists. They don't understand fully and completely, but the sad reality is they understand enough to be legally competent. Early on in my career, I would send some kids to be evaluated because I didn't think they understood it enough, or maybe they were slow, and those evaluations for competency routinely came back and said, this child is legally competent. Many of these evaluations are going to be under a statute that state that they're not admissible to the court for pre-adjudication. And what that means is the evaluation can occur, but unless it's waived and released, it's not to be put in front of a court unless there's been a plea or unless there's been a trial. Now, whether there's a plea or whether there's a trial, it will go to something called an adjudication and disposition hearing. There's something really great about juvenile court that's dramatically different from adult court, and that is we don't have a trial penalty. And even though it's unconstitutional, it's the sad reality of the criminal justice system that most of the time, if you go to trial as an adult, you pay for it, because the judges like it when inmates go back to the jail and have been maxed out, because they understand, and the prosecutors like that also, and that's why the prosecutors want more time. You know, the system is set up for plea bargaining. The system is set up to, like, take this deal or else. But the beautiful thing in juvenile court for juvenile delinquency is we don't have that, because the Department of Juvenile Justice, after a trial or after a plea, the department does something called a predisposition report. And that's what's commonly called a PDR. And the judge has to follow that unless there's legal reasons to go above it. And it's hard to go above it. Many times the judge wants to go above it. Many times the state attorney wants the judge to go above the recommendation. But it's usually just because they disagree with the recommendation. And there's plenty of case law saying if all the court did was disagree, that's not enough. Basically, there has to be legal reasons in the best interest of the child on why a more restrictive placement would have to be why it would be appropriate. Now, the guardians can be involved in helping these dispositions, because most of the time you don't just plead and pass it for a predisposition report. If you have a trial, that's normally what happens, but most of the pleas are negotiated. Again, that's where the guardians can be very, very helpful to help develop a plan, to help develop alternatives, and to work with the defense lawyer who will be working with the prosecutor and hopefully coming up with some agreement that the judge also would sign off on. A lot of times when we have these crossover cases, anything that a child is going to get in a residential commitment program, the child can get via DCF. And if that's the case, and the child isn't a risk to public safety or a flight risk, meaning the child would basically just take off and not agree to participate in these services, if the guardian can work with the lawyer saying, hey, he doesn't need to be sent off, we can get him these anger management classes, we can get him these services, we can get him this, we can get him that, we have a special program for this, and if the guardian can help develop something special like that, it gives us more options. So that's where you can come in very, very helpful. Now, I know the chart is somewhat confusing because I've got so many different arrows, but sometimes even after a trial, we don't necessarily need a predisposition report. And it can be waived, and there can be an agreed-upon disposition, because maybe the state and the court realize that this case is probably just a probation case. Why delay it? Why come back a month later to put them on probation? There's nothing else out there worse than probation. And again, if a child is placed on probation, it just really helps for the guardian to kind of monitor that probation. We don't have reviews here. Now, the statute allows you to have reviews, meaning a child could be placed on probation and come back to court a month later to follow the status. And that really doesn't happen. And instead, letters may be written to the court. At some point, a child may come back before the court on a violation of probation, which we don't like to see. So I think the guardians can be really helpful by working with the child, by constantly talking with the child, making sure the child's doing what the child is supposed to do, making sure that the guardian needs to look at that probation order, look at that disposition order to see just what needs to be done, work with the child, and help that child successfully complete it, as opposed to the child coming back on some type of violation. Now, the last page of the flow chart is on disposition, and Florida is really very, very limited with what can happen at disposition for a child in juvenile court. There can be court costs. There can be cost of supervision, which is $1 a day if a child's on probation. There could also be something called cost of care, which means if a child is sent to a residential program, could be charged up to $5 a day. There could also be restitution. Now, the law says that both the child or the parent can be responsible for these costs. And it's really widely different all over the state, and it even differs in some location over time. I've practiced some years where the judges on the delinquency bench don't believe that child should have to pay, and they always impose everything on the parents. Generally, it's imposed on the child and the parent. And with crossover children not having parents in the picture, DCF would be the parent. There's funds to pay restitution for that. Normally, the cost of supervision or care would be waived. But what basically can happen at disposition is a child could be committed, meaning sent to a program, or it could be put on probation. And if you look at my little box that has probation underneath it, it says path to complete ? If you really look at the statute, it looks like the judge has to either put a child on probation or commit them. Sometimes we have something called a path to complete, where a child's to do some hours, to do some drug counseling, to do a letter of apology, to attend some classes, and if the child does it, we'll suspend further sanctions. It's somewhat questionable whether that's legal. And on a trial case once, a judge did a pass to complete, and the state challenged it here, and ultimately the judge did an order agreeing with the state saying, yes, it has to be probation or a commitment. I had sent that up to the DJJ lawyers in Tallahassee. That was the first they had seen of it. I don't know if that's going around the state. But basically with probation, there would be a number of conditions the child would be required to complete, and one would be to not commit any new law violations. If a child's committed, a child could be sent off, meaning go to a residential program, or a child could have a non-residential, meaning a day program. What that would mean is the child gets picked up in the morning and gets taken to the program and then gets taken back to his or her home during the evening. Those are called minimum risk commitments. The residential commitments are low, moderate, high, and maximum. Now, the judge can't say what specific commitment a child has to go to. A judge can only say what risk you are and what level of program. We used to have a lot of low risk programs that were only 30 to 45 days. Now most of the low risks are 4 to 6 months. The moderate programs are 6 to 9 months. The high-risk programs are 9 to 18 months. The maximum risk programs are 18 to 36. And when you hear these time limits, you might wonder, well, why 18, why 36? It's all based on how well a child does in the program. Sometimes we'll have a child who really is a pretty good kid who just gets caught up in something very, very serious, and they get sent to a high-risk program where they're going to be locked up potentially for 18 months. And a lot of those children will get out in less than 9 months because they know how to follow instructions. They don't want to be troublemakers. They don't want to fight the system. They don't want to cut out the staff. They just want to do what they need to do and get released. Other children have more difficulties with their personality, with getting along with people, with doing things that they don't want to do. And as such, they stay much, much longer time. Once the child they can be put on post-commitment probation, or they could be put on something called conditional release. And basically it means you're done with this program, but you're not completely done. And we want to monitor you. We want to make sure you don't go back into some of the habits, some of the lifestyle that you were in before that got you in trouble. Now, I don't know if the guardians would have the ability to continue contact the children and stay in touch with them. They can certainly use the mentoring and the contact from the guardians. Certainly, once they're released on the post-commitment probation or conditional release, again, it really helps if the guardians work with them and continually tell them that, hey, you don't want to get sent back to this. Because that's what can happen. If a child's on conditional release, the child can be sent back to the program for violating conditions of that conditional release. So they really need some help. So in summary, that's the system. In summary, the guardians can educate the attorney on the mitigation. The guardians can talk to the prosecutors concerning the mitigation and help for the child to have a better sentence. The guardians can coach and mentor the child to help him or her successfully complete the program they're in. The child or the guardians can help develop plans or alternatives that are more attractive to that child and more appropriate. The guardians can come to court and testify at disposition to help get a more appropriate disposition. The guardians can testify in court or just show their support at court appearances where the release status might be at issue. So there's a lot of areas that the guardians can really help out a child and can work with the child's attorney. So at this point, we've covered everything you need to know about the delinquency process, and we still have about 10 minutes for any questions that anybody may or may not have.
Okay, presentation mode is now disabled.
It's open now for anyone to ask questions of Rob.
What does the maximum detention awaiting placement, the 5 days, 15, and unlimited, what?
Okay, if you're detained, I mentioned you had 21 days for there to be a trial.
Hmm?
If you're detained and you either are found guilty or enter a plea, then there's a limit of 15 days until the disposition. Then when you come back 15 days later, that's when you might be put on probation or you might have the low, moderate, higher maximum. If you were sentenced to a higher maximum, there are no time limits, and you can be locked up until a bed becomes available. And years ago, on sex cases, because children were routinely being locked up for 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 months before going to their program. And because the program was based on certain areas they had to learn and certain accomplishments, even though they got credit, they didn't really get credit. They got credit for jurisdictional purposes, but if you're there in a felony and there's 5 years of jurisdiction, that didn't help you with the program. So higher maximum, and if you're locked up, you may be locked up until play. For the low risk, it's 5 business days. You can't be placed within 5 business days, you're released on home detention. Moderate risk, the placement would be 15 business days. Commonly comes out about 3 weeks.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Sure. Any other questions?
Are there any other questions for Rob? I have a question.
Go for it.
Okay, this is Kay James. I'm from the 8th Circuit. I'm in the rural counties. Can you tell us how you go about making sure that the guardian program is aware that one of their kids is going to be appearing at first appearance?
Well, I think you've identified a really good gap, because I'm not sure how a guardian would be made aware of it. Certainly in our county, I'm not sure how anybody is made aware of it, other than we get a detention calendar a few hours before detention. Now that's being, I'm not sure if that's released online, and I'm not sure if we have somebody at our local guardian ad litem's office that goes over that detention calendar to see if there's any of the children that they're involved with. But that, you know, that really is a, that really is, yeah, but that would seem to be the most effective way, would be guardian office themselves looked at that detention calendar each day and identified it. Now, in I don't know if it could be tied in from the clerk's office, if the clerk's office would have the ability to notify, but you know, it's just one of those ways with information age that we're fighting our way through, especially with the Unified Family Court.
I think
also,
that would be,
we
are usually very willing to be there, but we often do not know about when first appearances, our kids will be in first appearance, when they will be at other different court proceedings throughout the proceedings. So I think that information gap is our biggest problem.
This is Alicia. There are a couple of circuits where on intake, both sides, delinquency and investigations, are cross-checking the other system, and they have a notification system in their areas. So that's something that your circuits can talk with the other circuits about.
Okay, good.
Any other questions for Rob? Okay, Rob, thank you so much for putting together this presentation and your time today. Really informative. It's a great way to start our training series on crossover children.